This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Greatly appreciate y'all taking time today for joining us for another live edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort that's with us live, go ahead and scroll to the bottom of the page. That's where you'll find the chat room. Paul Withington, one of our regulars, has been with us since almost day one or year one. Hey, Paul, it's always great to see you there. If you want to join Paul and the rest of the usual suspects, that's the perfect place to go. There's some observations you would like to share during the course of the program, or if there's a question you would like for us to make sure that we address to our guests before the show is over with, that is the perfect place to put it. We'll do our best to fold it into the conversation as things go forward. And because this is a busy summer for everybody, if you got some honeydews to take care of and you want to check what you missed because you couldn't listen to the entire show or if you came in late for some reason, you can always get the full archive over at Spreaker. And we look forward to, if you want to make sure you don't miss anybody at any time, just go over to iTunes or any of your other podcast aggregators and subscribe to the podcast, and that'll make sure that you hear everything. But let's go ahead and roll into the show. Today we want to talk about, for navalists out there, it's been in the news. I want to say it's been in the news for the last few months, but it's pretty much been in the news for the last few thousand years. It just waxes and wanes in its importance. Because even though personalities change and people change, some empires and people haven't moved since the dawn of time. And of course, geography is always the same. The latest chapter in the book, though, involves limpet mines and tankers shooting down drones and some good old-fashioned escorting merchants by frigates. And long, long decades that we've seen, at least for myself, my co-host, and our guests, really the balance of our adult lives, Iran continues to posture in their near abroad it sees. A lot of it sounds familiar, and that's one thing that we'll touch on early on in the show, but time doesn't stand still. And economic and security needs, wants, and desires, not only for our nation and that of others, for this body of water, have changed over time. And what we want to do today is we want to look at what is constant, what has changed, and what should we expect to continue to evolve, and what is, regardless of which nation your passport comes from, is one of the most globally important bodies of water. And our returning guest today to discuss this and other areas on the same topic is Dr. John Kuhn. He is the General William Schoffcare of Historical Research at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. He retired from the U.S. Navy in 2004 at the rank of commander after 23 years of service as a naval flight officer in EP-3s and ES-3s. He authored Agents of Innovation in 2008 and co-authored Eyewitness Pacific Theater with D.M. Yan Creco, as well as numerous other articles and editorials, and he was awarded the Mankato Prize for the Society of Military History in 2011. John joins us today as himself. He does not necessarily represent the views of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College or any other organizations that he may be party to. John, it's great to have you back. Welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks for having me back, Sal. Thanks, Eagle One.
And, hey, just to kind of kick things off, to kind of keep on something I touched on in the intro, geography matters. One of my predilections whenever something comes up, whether I've spent days and months there or not, I'm going to go grab the chart and look at the chart. So just for the listener, and coming from your point of view, as a naval officer, but also a guy who has his PhD and is soaked in history. You're working with the Army day in and day out, so you get a lot of that point of view through osmosis, but you've also been there in person. So from that point of view, when you're looking at the geography, when you're looking at the map, time and distance, what's at the top of your brief sheet that you want to make sure, as we talk this hour, the listener keeps in mind about the Strait of Hormuz, the Arabian Sea, the Gulf of Oman, and the Arabian or Persian Gulf, depending on who's our friend for the day? Over to you.
Okay, let me repeat the question back to you so I make sure I answer the right question. What do I want the readers or the readers? You can tell I'm a writer, so I'm always thinking readers. What do I want the listeners to keep in mind with respect to the geography of the greater Middle East region? Something along those lines?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, the first thing is that the Middle East, the greater Middle East, so that means the Levant, the coast off of Lebanon and Israel and Syria, the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb, the Horn of Africa, up through the North Arabian Sea, into the Gulf of Oman, and then into the Persian Gulf, is a long way away from the continent of North America. Now, you can go to a globe and check that in case you didn't recognize any of those places that I said. And these days, Sal, we can't take it for granted that even our naval listeners will recognize those places, although one would hope they would, since most of them were bodies of water, although there were a few coastlines in there. So this is a very, very long way away from the United States in a time-distance sense. So when some place is as far away as that, but we're so heavily involved with it, we really need to look at our geography. We need to think about how long does it take to get there? How do we sustain forces once they're there, either on the sea, in the air, or on land? And so those are logistics questions tied to the geography of this place. We will call it B, place B. And place A will represent, of course, the North American continent. So B is a long way away from A. So B better be real damn important if you're going to go all the way from A to B. And it depends on which way you go. I mean, quick time out for a little sea story here. In 1998, I got orders to go to the John C. Stennis, which was at that time stationed in the Gulf, at the ready, because there was a crisis, as usual, in the Persian Gulf, not with respect to Iran, who at the time we were cooperating somewhat tacitly with, but with, of course, Saddam Hussein in Iraq and the sanctions that had been levied on him that he was violating, particularly the sanctions with respect to oil. And so so I got on an airplane in San Diego and flew from there to Chicago, to Rotterdam, to Dahrain, which is in Saudi Arabia. So some of the ground pounders might recognize that one. The Navy guys might have a hard time with that. And then to Bahrain. And then from there on a carrier onboard delivery aircraft under the C-2 Greyhound out to the USS John C. Stennis. So that was an incredibly long journey. In fact, that was a great year because the Stennis then went from the Persian Gulf all the way back to San Diego. So I literally went around the world in less than 80 days that summer. But it's a long way away. And unless you've never really done that, particularly the last half of it on a ship, you don't realize the distance. It takes a long time to get an M1A1 Abrams tank from wherever the hell those things are finally put together at in the United States to there. So it's a long ways away. How's that for an answer?
Perfect.
Yeah, it's a pretty good answer. And speaking as one of the Navy guys who was actually assigned to a MEU unit, Mobile Inshore Undersea Warfare Unit, in Dairon during the first Gulf War, I can tell you a lot of Navy people actually know where that is, because we were where they were delivering. They were delivering M1A2, I think, Abrams tanks those days. Let's talk a little bit about kind of currently with what's going on with Iran. Why does Iran, what is it attempting to do with these, what apparently with the Limpet mines, this attempted apparently trying to force a British tanker into Iranian waters? Let's start with now and kind of work backwards. What got us to this situation?
Well, that's usually pretty hard for historians, because we like to give you all the context and then make a suggestion at the end, right? We don't make a claim. We don't make a bold argument. We say, well, and this suggests this, kind of a wishy-washy approach. So starting out with something bold and then working backwards is sort of contrary to the way historians do business. So I won't be a historian. I'll be a naval officer. And so I'll do the bold thing right up front, even though I've been a little bit verbose here. So the thing with Iran goes way, way back. Iran is a regional power. Period. Okay? Iran is a regional power. She's in a regional power under duress, under pressure, who recently seemed to be waxing in terms of her regional power, particularly with the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, known to most of your listeners out there as the nuke deal with Iran, that was unilaterally abrogated by the United States with the new Trump administration. So Iran is a regional power who was doing better and is now doing worse, and most of the doing worse has to do with the actions of the United States. Well, why is this important? It's not. So I'm going to give you my bottom line up front. It's not important. There's some little things we can talk about here on the margins, like, yeah, it's great. It's a lot more important for the United Kingdom. That's called Great Britain for some people, than it is for us. So it makes a whole lot of sense for the Royal Navy to get off its ass and start being a real damn Navy again and escorting Royal Navy ships that are of interest to the United Kingdom in terms of sea control and escorting ships that are important to their economic needs and those perhaps of Europe than it is to us. That goes back to the first question that Sal asked me, sort of the geography thing, which was, you know, the region, all we have to do is get back in our time machine and go back to 1978. And we go back to 1978, and Iran was a very powerful regional power, a very powerful regional power indeed, underwritten by the United States. Our strategy back then was to build up the regime of the Shah of Iran, who seemed like a Ataturk kind of a figure, although certainly not the hero to his countrymen that Ataturk was for Turkey, but a figure that was secularizing and modernizing Iran, and that were going to be a counterweight to our real enemies in the region, who seemed to be those people who were threatening our ally Israel and making trouble in the Middle East with Israel. Notice I haven't used that three-letter word yet, oil. However, what happens is, and my recommendation here for your listeners, if they haven't read it and they want all the context that they can't get from, 5 hours with John Kuhn blathering on, is to get The Twilight War by David Crisp, and they can get the entire sordid context from that. But what happened was Iran became important in a different way for the United States, not just as a regional power that was going to balance out interests there for us and that was going to also serve as a Cold War counterweight to the Soviet Union, which we were worried about extending its claws into Afghanistan at the time. So does this all sound familiar? It's like a frickin' broken record, isn't it, guys? Okay, parenthetical over. So back to it. So Iran went through a revolution. The revolution took about 3 years. By the end of the revolution, the United States foreign policy in the region was in tatters, in absolute tatters. Worse than that, aside from being forced into bed with an extremely unsavory character named Saddam Hussein at Baghdad, the United States now had to worry about oil, because the United States had learned in 1973 that we couldn't survive without OPEC oil. We didn't need to piss OPEC off. And now all of a sudden, one of the major players in OPEC was right there with real estate right on the Gulf, and they were no longer our friend. They were our enemy, holding our citizens hostage and at risk. And it's really been a tit for tat with Iran ever since then. The best chance, of course, and I've talked to you about this, and I've written editorials and articles on it in Proceedings and Joint Force Quarterly and other places, would have been to sort of make nice with Iran after 9/11, when Iran reached out and offered their support, both in Afghanistan and in Iraq for us, and then we put them on the bad guy list and shot ourselves in the foot. So the tit for tat really started in 2017 with the Trump administration, which stocked DOD and the uniform military leadership with, I'm almost loath to characterize them this way, Iran haters. And so the tit for tat began. So everything that's been going on has been Iran scrambling, trying to sort of get back the power and influence that it is really losing in the region. Now, if our strategy is to undermine Iran's influence in the region, it's an extremely successful strategy. It really is. I actually forced the regime in Baghdad to start second-guessing itself with respect to being used as a giant rat line to Lebanon and Hezbollah in Lebanon, and through the dead zone of the Syrian civil war geography there. If that's the goal of the strategy, but that's not. That's actually sort of some serendipitous fallout. I think the goal always has been, at least from what I can determine, is for guys like Bolton and Pompeo, although Pompeo's been reined in the last couple of weeks, that's their Secretary of State, a West Point graduate, as Secretary of State, let that sink in a little bit, is to start a war with Iran. I am one of those people who actually believes we're doing Israel's job for it, and at the same time, we're protecting everybody else's oil. But we don't need that oil anymore. The Carter Doctrine, which was established in 1978, is no longer effective. Prior to then, we never put aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf. In fact, throughout the 1980s, when the Carter Doctrine was in effect, we were very low to put aircraft carriers into the Persian Gulf. And as you all know, I'm on the record as not putting aircraft carriers in there. And even the Gulf of Oman, you're getting a little close. And I mean, they used to get so scared in the Gulf of Oman. Maybe we'll have time for my sea story about how scared the Navy used to be of the Iranians, even in the Gulf of Oman, to say nothing of the Persian Gulf. So there's this tit for tat going on. And so it involves us pulling out of the nuclear treaty, the Iranians responding in really the only way they can. The economic sanctions are really hurting them. But the real, perhaps, bad thing going on here is that we're making it more likely that that regime change is not going to take place, that we're going to undermine the moderate forces that are in Iran, and only increase the forces of reaction and hardlineism, for lack of a better term, or hardline Islamic Shia Islam, which, by the way, most of the terrorist acts in the world don't come from reactionary Shia Islam. They're very localized. They're localized in the Levant, in Beirut, and with Hezbollah. But for the most part, your average street corner is extremely safe from the radicals in Shia Islam. Now, if you're on a street corner in Beirut, no, you're not. Or in Israel, maybe not, although I think rockets from Hamas are probably more problems there. So it's a tit-for-tat that's going on. It's a dangerous game, and I've noticed it seems like there's been some de-escalation there. I've also noticed that some of our allies seem to be stepping up to the plate. I don't know if there was an intention there to sort of get some of these light riders or free riders to start pulling some more of their weight. But I love the idea of a European coalition in the Persian Gulf without any U.S. aircraft carrier strike groups attached to it, kind of keeping the peace in there like we did back in the 1980s in Ernest Will and Praying Mantis.
You know, you mentioned Iranian haters and it's hardliners. Of course, you say hardliners, you could be on both sides of the equation. But it has me thinking, you know, I am the youngest man here. You're a couple years older than I am, not too much.
1957, Sal.
You've aged well. You've taken good care of yourself. For our adult lives, Iran, and some of this is personal to me because I grew up with the kids of Iranians who were in college when the revolution took place, and they got word from their parents, don't come home, and they stayed here. My neighbor right now is originally from Iran. As I like to tell people, one of the largest Iranian cities in the world is Los Angeles. And it's not a terror hotspot by any way. Iranians, Persians, whatever you want to call them, they make great Americans. But in our adult life, the conflict and the friction with Iran since the late 1970s has been a constant. It's all wrapped up with access to oil because an even older cohort of people, and I remember as a kid sitting in gas lines with my dad back in 73 because we had a noose around our neck that led all the way back to the Middle East, reliance on oil. And most of the policymakers are our age and significantly older. And so their adult lives and their professional life has always been bound by one of these universal constants, which is the constant friction and pushback and the feeling that it's the American responsibility to confront Iran. And the Iranian leadership is the same. You know, we just can't quit each other, so to speak. But that was then, and this is now, is a lot of, and we've both seen it from both sides of the equation, that knee-jerk reaching for the military option every time Iran goes outside the lifelines. How much of this is generational and instinct and habit unless taking a deep breath and evaluating what today's needs are?
I think there is a generational aspect to this. I mean, I'm like you, Sal. If anybody's got a reason to be unhappy with things that various ethnicities and states in the Middle East have done, it's me. I'm right there with you. I'm the same generation, you know. I was in those gas lines in my Pinto, and I actually was driving, all right, going, are they going to run out of gas before I get a full tank? But that wasn't the Iranians. That was our wonderful allies doing that. So the first point I want to make is there's a conflation in memory. And so this speaks to the generational problem. Part of the generational problem is a lot of the Americans don't make distinctions between Middle Easterners, or, and I'm going to use this is a pejorative racist terminology that was used back in the day, particularly in the 70s, ragheads. All ragheads are the same. And so there's this conflation of all these different peoples who are from that region, most of whom are Islamic and worship Allah, that they're all the same, and so they're all to blame. Okay, so
neighbor, one of his favorite lines is, I'm not from the Middle East, I'm from Persia.
Right. So that's why I called it the Greater Middle East. Persia's always been a problem in world history. You made that statement at the start of the show. I mean, I go back to the Romans. The Romans never solved the problem of Persia, ever. They never solved it. Now, the Persians weren't real great at projecting power outside of a sort of a regional area, and that may have been a technology thing or not. But, I mean, if you look over the long duration at the, you know, from Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon all the way, you know, all the way down through the millennia to today, the people and empires have always had a hard time with Persia. I mean, look, Sunni Islam hasn't solved the problem of Persia, okay? The Russians have never solved the problem of Persia, even though they wanted to, you know, and turn it into a giant Russian-speaking colony. But so there's this conflation, I think, that's part of the generational problem. So, you know, people can be forgiven for thinking, well, they're all the same, and they made me wait in gas lines when I was a teenager, and, you know, and that pissed me off. But, you know, now I'm a little bit older, and I know who made me wait in gas lines, and his name was Anwar Sadat. That's who made me wait in the gas line. And as it turned out, Anwar probably did the right thing, although at the time it was very painful. And he was assassinated for it by the predecessor or the precursor of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda for it. You know, we flew the flag at half-mast for the man who made us wait in gas lines. And I have plenty of reason to be angry at the Iranians because of the hostage crisis. That was a cathartic, humiliating event. I tell my students, so we had Vietnam, and for 13 years, it sucked. And it ruined political careers, and it ruined dreams, and it ruined all sorts of things. And then we got rid of that Vietnam canard around our necks, and then we had the Iranian hostage crisis. So the humiliations of the 70s just seemed to pile up. And so we've sort of turned, or some people, I think, have sort of turned Iran into the icon for all of these hatreds, disappointments, and humiliations, just as the Iranians did the same thing with us. You know, their humiliation was a result of us. The Chinese are doing the same thing, by the way. They, Western, you know, humiliation, the century of humiliation, and it was Western, and it was the Westerners' fault. So we put these icons on things for our troubles in the past. They form these narratives, but when they inform policy, they become extremely problematic. And so, yeah, I think Jim Mattis hates Iranians because they supported Hezbollah, and Hezbollah blew up his brother Marines in Beirut, and some brother Frenchmen, too. We always forget about the 120 or so Frenchmen, French Foreign Legionnaires, who were killed in Beirut, too. We always forget about that. And that's in The Twilight War by David Crist. David Crist, you can thank me. I plug your book so much. So that informs policy. These are guys who developed this attitude. The turning point for me, Sal, was there's two turning points for me in my understanding of these things. And you know, you're always kind of thinking and going back, and you think you've explained something based on your understanding at the time. And then as you get older and wiser, it sort of informs a new understanding of things. And so as long as we can modify our understanding with new evidence and new data, I think we'll be okay. So the first for me was in 1983, Christmas, 1983. I'm sitting in Guam. I've just finished flying 600 hours in 6 months during a particularly busy operational period of the Cold War in the EP3, you know, and I'm exhausted. I mean, 600 hours in 6 months is a lot of flying, Sal. It's a lot of frickin' flying. And I was busy as hell. I was the navigator, and so I was very, very busy on the EP3 doing that. So I'm relaxing, and I get the phone call, the Christmas phone call. Every military person knows what we're talking about. Hey, John, we need you to deploy. But don't worry, you're going to deploy to the Philippines, and it'll be, you fly your wife over, Mac, you know, and you guys can live in the BOQ, you know, and celebrate New Year's in the Philippines at the QBO Club. And I said, well, could be worse, right? So, I get over to the Philippines. I'm going to be flying out of there against Camron Bay, against that first humiliation, the frickin' Vietnam humiliation, you know, the war that didn't hurt our strategic interests, you know, when the Soviets moved into Vietnam with major bases. Yeah, I was going to be flying that thing, but that's okay. I'm okay with that. That's what I signed on to do. And then we get the second phone call in the QBBOQ, and that's in the Philippines, dear listeners, the QBBOQ, Subic Bay, for those of you who want to look at a map. And that second phone call is, go to Oman. Bring civilian clothes. You are going to fly for the carrier battle group that's in the Gulf of Oman on patrol on one of those patrols that was left over from the Iranian hostage crisis, for God's sake. You know, one of those poor carriers, Independence or Kitty Hawk or Shitty Hawk, as we used to call her, is out there tooling back and forth in the Gulf of Oman, and they've got hot intel that the Iranians are going to launch suicide attacks against the carrier. On top of that, the venerable A3 Whale, which is the SIGINT platform protecting the carrier from such attacks, is hard down on the flight deck, taking up all the flight deck space for an entire A7 squadron, I suspect. So the Kitty Hawk says that we got to have support, send us an EP3. So I get to fly against the Iranians, and they ruined my Christmas in 1983, and they ruined my New Year's in 1983-84. So I got plenty to be kind of gripe against the Iranians. Oh, later we learn bad intel brought us over there. There was no Iranian threat to the battle group. It was bad intel. We learned this later. That's about all I can go into on that particular matter. So you know, right away it's like, well, were the Iranians, or were they our enemies, or was that all just a bunch of bullshit and knee-jerk reaction? You can see where I'm going with this nowadays in terms of the stuff that's happening today. Well, let's fast forward to 2000. I'm going into the Persian Gulf for the fourth, fifth, maybe sixth time in my Navy career. I lose count, right? 80s and 90s. So I'm going in there, you know, because I was a Gulf War guy. And I'm going in there through the Strait of Hormuz. And as we're going through there, the Iranians contact us by radio and challenge the carrier like they always do, right? And so what happens, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Loud and clear.
Okay, yeah. I thought I might have lost you because I had another phone call coming in. So, you know, I'm the CDC officer, so I'm right there in combat. I've got my TAOs primed and ready. We've got the 50 cals mounted on the USS John C. Stennis. The bridge has got, they're all ready to record all this stuff and say, hey, we're conducting a transit passage in international waters, and tape it all. And so this little Iranian voice comes up, you know, on the open circuits, open net, nothing classified here, you know, USS Warship, state your intentions. And we say, hey, we are Warship 74 proceeding on transit passage into the Persian Gulf. Well, we didn't even say that. We're proceeding on transit passage in international waters. And then this little Iranian guy comes back and goes, okay, we'll see you in about 3 months when you come out. Out. I was like, well, that was really crazy. Those bad Iranians, they sound real threatening, right? So we get in there, and we start to work with the Iranians in catching sanctions violators from Iraq. They're practically our freaking allies. All we got to do is stay out of this one area of the Persian Gulf, and everybody, and it was sort of this tacit agreement to do it, you know, like a kilometer, you know, beyond the international, you know, line or whatever. And the Iranians are going to work with us, and they do. And me and Mike Lefevre, who was just a lowly Captain Commodore back then, the Desron guy, we worked that problem, and things went great. We busted a lot of sanction violators. Yeah, we didn't know the UN was selling all that stuff and getting kickbacks and stuff to Saddam. But anyway, it was, you know, so the Iranians were like, and I'm like, this is weird. I think the Iranians might not be such bad guys anymore. So that's kind of what informs my thinking about the Iranians. I know that they have a ruthless, oppressive government. They have a bunch of old, what's the word for it? They have a geriatric theocracy, right? A geriatric theocracy that can see modernity pressing on it from all sides. And they don't want to lose it. They have these allies in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps who are allied with them. But even some of these Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps guys are starting to kind of get modern, even though they're pretty ruthless, nasty customers. So I think these things inform the way we think about the Iranians. They inform the way that I think about the Iranians. And on top of all this, the problem with securing the world oil supply is, you know, the only thing that we could possibly influence is so that the prices at the pumps don't go up. Although I could say there's plenty of foreign policies that we could adopt that would make those prices go down, that would involve rapprochement with the Iranians. And so I want to see us kind of walk this thing back. The other problem here is the Iranians are trying to project power in the Horn of Africa, in the Bab el-Mandeb, because of the Yemeni civil war. And so they're supporting their proxies and their guys there who've been fighting in Yemen for, 50 years they've been fighting in Yemen, between North and South Yemen and the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen and the Yemenis Arab Republic and all these different names for the different groups there. But bottom line, it's a religious ethnic thing. The Iranians are supporting their Shia guys and the Saudis are supporting their Sunni guys. And so there's a war going on down there. So I think most of the stuff that's related to the shipping issues that are taking place in the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf right now have to do with that war. It's just fighting back. It's war. And the Saudis are in a war down there. And so they think they can restrict the war zone to Yemen, Horn of Africa, and the Red Sea, and keep it out of the Persian Gulf. I think that's extremely naive and arrogant of the Saudis.
John, you're still there?
Yeah, I think he said that he had ended, and I was supposed to ask a question, and I couldn't find my button. So. the hostage crisis took place 40 years ago. I mean, that was 1979. We're coming up on its 40th anniversary, which means a lot of the radical students, which whatever, days are now probably in their 60s. They're probably about your age, John, a little younger than me. yeah. And they looked back. They looked back to the 1950s when the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency helped a coup take out their government. I mean, there's always an excuse that the Westerners have led to this, as you've already said, but. We've got a situation now where they are trying to increase their capability of regional hegemony by developing some kind of nuclear weapons. They're getting advanced missile systems, advanced for the area, from North Korea, maybe the Chinese, well, certainly the Chinese, perhaps the Russians. And I guess if we're concerned, and here we go back to those days of the late 1970s, the Carter Doctrine was worried about not only the oil flow to the U.S. out of that region, but also about the Russian influence in that. We had this, and so, thus we've ended up with these carriers and other battle groups in that part of the world for a long time. Given that the U.S. is probably for the first time and memory, basically energy independent. Is there a reason that we shouldn't just say, look, the Japanese, the Brits, the French, whoever else is dependent on the Germans, whoever else is dependent on the oil flows, the Chinese out of the Strait of Hormuz, you guys, and this is, I think, what President Trump has done, is you guys should be taking on a lot of this load that we've been carrying for the last 40 years instead of us doing it by ourselves. Is there a flaw in my historical knowledge and logic?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think there is at all. Again, whether or not, the fact that the British, the French, maybe even the Chinese are going to pick up some of the load here. Certainly the British are picking up some of the load. I mean, they've had a radical about turn on defense policy with respect to the Royal Navy. I mean, they've been, the Royal Navy is the second service now in an island nation, which is just beyond rational. I've read the Royal United Services Institute Journal for years and years and years, and the writers in there, Jeffrey Clark and Hugh Strawn, and they've been bemoaning this because of these land wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the fact that the British Army now is the number one service, and the Royal Navy is now number two, and so I don't know if that's serendipitous, but I agree with your analysis that I think we were in a pretty good situation, though. I think we were in a better situation to deal with a number of these issues based on the policies of the previous administration. as flawed as it was, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was actually kind of got everybody into the same room. The Iranians were actually adhering to it. Yes, right there. There was no guarantees that down the road, under the terms of the agreement, that the Iranians could kind of get things started again and make advances and everything. But we were, the trajectory, the momentum was in the right direction towards that particular nuclear problem, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about in a second, but also in terms of stability in the region with oil prices and everything, there was that. Now, as far as the Russians are concerned, of course, with the Cold War, that all went away. And you're absolutely right about the Carter Doctrine encompassing more than just the security of the world's oil. It was a Cold War doctrine as much as it was an economic doctrine in terms of vital interests of the United States. If people had been had their correct thinking caps on, we would have had a big conference in 1992 or something where we kind of figured everything out, with the Iranians. But the Iranian animosity, and when you read Twilight War, you see this at almost every turn. When the United States starts to be moderate its views, the Iranians kind of harden theirs, and then the United States hardens theirs. And, you know, so there's only been a couple inflection points over the last, you know, ever since the Iran hostage crisis in 1979, there's only been a couple inflection points. One of them was 2016. Another one of them was right after 9/11, and certainly right after the Cold War ended, where coming up with a much better strategy that's win-win for all parties was capable. Now, the nuclear piece is a real concern. I'm not poo-pooing that. The problem is it doesn't seem to pay to work with the United States on these things when the United States makes threats. Look at North Korea. Iran is looking at North Korea and going, hey, you know, the United States can't get that under control. Do we really think they'll get us under control and tell us what to do with economic sanctions and all of these other forms of pressure? I don't know. We hate to see a new member of the nuclear club at any point in time. You know, I'm a big believer in conferences and treaties and things like the ABM Treaty and SALT and START. We don't have enough of that nowadays. That's a big, big gap that exists right now. Now, a lot of it has to do with our adversaries and competitors. A couple of years ago, I thought we should have another Washington Naval Conference with China and Russia and the United States. And people told me, no, John, we can't. That'll give them legitimacy. Well, has our bargaining position improved since I made that proposal 10 years ago? No. So we're sort of in a declining returns environment, I think, with Iran. They're enriching uranium. They passed a milestone just this last week. They notified, per the treaty, for the people who are still adhering to it. They were hoping that the Europeans would, and their animosity toward the Trump administration would actually cause the Europeans to migrate a little bit more towards them. But that didn't work out for them as much as they thought it would. So it's an extremely complicated situation. It's almost like we're in a lose-lose situation. And then on top of it, you've got this group of uniformed military advisors with some key non-uniformed advisors like Pompeo and Bolton, who think the military tool is the way to get there, but the military tool has been a spectacular failure now for such a long time that I can hardly remember the last time it succeeded. I guess we got to go back to our Gulf War, right, guys, and say, hey, that was kind of like a success. So anyway, that's sort of my response. I'm agreeing with you almost entirely.
Yeah, that instinct to immediately reach for the military side of the equation gets kind of old, but I think what we've seen in its crossed administrations is it's always, you know, people can say what they want to say, but let's watch what they're doing. And when you look at the military interactions we've had with the Iranians, I think the record shows we've actually shown some pretty good restraint, whether during the Obama administration they will go with the go with the published story. They downed one of our Sentinel drones. We recently lost one of our BAMs, the big naval version of the Global Hawk that's land-based out of there. We've really been leaning a lot towards ISR, and it was clear with the latest limpet mining that they were trying to provoke us into what was historically our reaction. And then initially what you saw over here was, you know, where are the aircraft carriers? Where's the fleet? But because things are different economically and hydrocarbon world, what we're actually seeing is lots of ISR, a few enabling troops ashore that tactically don't move the needle anywhere, but strategically and messaging-wise are useful. But we have the British using one of their frigates to escort one of their national ships. And you hear on the fringes, well, if we don't do it, then the Chinese, the Indians, or the Japanese will go in there and escort their ships.
Great.
Is it safe to say that is actually a feature, not a bug, and something that we should embrace?
Yeah, I mean, the folks that say, you know, there's this great scene in a movie that I love where, so I got to tell you the scene because it'll set up my response here to your question about this. So General Kutuzov is outside Moscow and Napoleon is inside Moscow. And there's all this partisan guerrilla warfare going on against Napoleon's supply lines all the way back to Paris. And so the French send an emissary to talk to General Kutuzov to say, hey, can you make these guys stop? This isn't legal. This isn't, you know, this is beyond humanity. You know, there's nothing we can do about it. And Kutuzov goes, well, you know, I agree with you in every respect, you know, but what can I do? You know, I don't have control over these guys either. So that's my first vignette, which is to point out that things are extremely complex. What the government of Iran is not this controlling Politburo that presses a button and all these things happen. So it's not this monolithic thing. The regular military in Iran and the Iranian Republic Revolutionary Guard Corps are two completely different institutions, and they fought each other on occasion since the revolution. Fought each other. Battles. Gun battles. I mean, one side of the runway, IRGC, the other side of the runway, Iranian Air Force, firing at each other and killing each other. Okay? These things never make it out of Iran or sometimes. So one problem, of course, is understanding what's going on in Iran and how things happen. I, for one, don't believe that the Iranians started this off. I think it was either Houthi agents trying to kind of drag Iran in, kicking and screaming, or more nefariously, perhaps the agents of another power in the region, perhaps the UAE, because the Iranians were right at that time in some very delicate negotiations where they were trying to appear moderate. What the government was actually saying, you know, that gets back to what saying and doing. The problem is who's doing the doing and who's doing the saying, and are they on the same sheet of music? Are they on the same agenda? It's like our nation. I mean, Mattis has got one agenda and Trump's got another agenda. And oh, by the way, they were 180 out most of the time until Mattis was finally fired. I know he wasn't fired, but he was fired. Let's face it, he was fired. So that's the same thing. The other thing that I want your listeners to understand is that this is an extremely complex situation. We are not seeing anything like ground truth for all this stuff that's happening, all right? A British frigate, okay, that's ground truth. Somebody attacks some ships, ground truth, but it's kind of like the Gulf of Tonkin, right? We don't really know what's going on. I mean, Johnson, what did he say about that? The Navy might have been shooting at whales out there, for all I know. That's a pretty good quotation for your listeners to understand. with all this IR, ISR, all these national assets and BAMs and, you know, which replace EP3s and all this stuff that we have out there, our understanding of these things is extremely, and you're talking to a guy, it's opaque. You're talking to a guy, this was my job, was to figure out what the hell ground truth was, both as a combat direction center officer, but also as an EP3 CVAL, senior evaluator. You know, and there were times where I got back and I thought, hey, I got about an 80% understanding of things. And then a couple of days later, I was like, well, you know, I was probably doing pretty good if I understood 10% of what was actually going on. Yeah, you know, a Soviet aircraft carrier came out of port in Vladivostok. But other than that, I don't know anything, why it came out, what it did, where it went, when it went back in, who commanded it. You know, I don't understand. So your leaders need to understand that about this environment, that even, you know, we think, well, we've got all this high-tech ISR and everything, so we know what happened. And then you hear in the news reports, you read these nefarious, dark little asides, right? You know, intel sources say this, or the intel sources say that, you know, and the intel says this, or you'll see it in a forum, perhaps, where, hey, I've got access to intel, and if you saw the intel that I saw, boy, you'd be on my side of the fence. Well, I was on that side of the fence, Sal. For 23 years, I was on that side of the fence. Even longer than that, if you look at when my special clearance, for lack of a better word, finally expired, you know, as a civilian. You know, over 30 years, you know, in the biz, on the other side of the fence, behind the green door. And I'm telling you, we didn't know shit.
Well, we always knew that about intel officers. We just never said it out loud.
My designator is an unrestricted line community designator.
Oh, I'm just pulling your leg. On a larger level, I mean, some stuff seems fairly obvious that, to me anyway, and not being an intel officer, and I'm a lowly SWO, but if you're looking at that region and you're looking at what we have built up our allies in that area, so the UAE, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Iraqis, and Israel, all have benefited. Probably Israel has also done a lot, certainly has done a lot on its own, all have benefited from U.S. assistance to set themselves up to provide a defense against the blackmail that Iran would like its regional hegemony, I never learned how to say that word. And, you know, is there a point when we can say, we know, you know, like the UAE and the Saudis are not really going to do anything about these small boat things that the IRGC is doing, IRGCN is doing, because they don't want to get, you know, they don't want to get zapped. They're with their, they can, the Iranians can reach out and touch them pretty quickly if they have to or want to. Is there a point at which there is enough stability just built in that this area can kind of calm down a little bit, or is that we're going to wait for all these old theocrats to die before that happens?
Well, the thing that bothers me most is how this environment and ambience of crisis continues to get stoked, particularly by the media. I find it odd that, you know, I don't know if you saw my Twitter thing where I said they're like a bunch of six-year-old kids on a soccer team. You know, they follow the ball, but there's no strategic sort of, hey, maybe we should put some reporters over here, you know, near the goal, you know, so we can be ready, you know, or maybe we should learn about what's going on inside Iran and do more stories on you know, more Iran watching, you know, and that kind of thing. But so the allies, the Israelis, the Saudis, the UAE, Oman, nominally the regime in Baghdad, although it's they're closer to Tehran than they are to Washington, figuratively and literally. I mean, here's my response to that. Inasmuch as friendships are less steadfast than they sometimes seem, international security is best advanced by a calm examination of a nation's interests rather than by frenzied appeals to an imaginary love. That's Lewis Sears in 1927 said that. In other words, nations have interests. They don't have friends. So we think we've built up some sort of goodwill on the parts of these nations towards us, and that we're going to get some benefits, you know, because of some imaginary love. We're kidding ourselves. We're kidding ourselves, okay? We have commitments to Israel, but those commitments serve Israel a whole hell of a lot better than they serve the United States. We have commitments to Saudi and to the UAE and to some of our other Gulf partners and everything. But, you know, we have to remember, we don't get this stuff for free. There's a price to be paid, and we're paying that price right now. The price we're paying is, okay, you've started a stupid criminal little war down in Yemen, and we're going to back you, even if that drags us in to a larger problem with Iran. All right? So I think there's this sort of misunderstanding about realpolitik in Washington about what we get and what we don't get. And I think a clear-eyed examination of interests is a better way to go. I'm not completely convinced that the only actor in the Straits of Hormuz, in the southern Persian Gulf, in the northern Gulf of Oman, is just the IRGC. I think there's other actors at work. The Russians have shown us how to do this. They've shown the British how to do this. They've shown everybody how to do this kind of thing. And for Americans to think that Sunni Arab regimes might not be able to do this kind of thing with little green men and agents provocateur and things like this is just naive. It's just naive. So that said, the IRGC is a nasty bunch of customers. They're kind of going through a little bit of an identity crisis right now. I'd like to see another New Yorker article. There was a wonderful one on Soleimani. That's the head of the IRGC, dear listeners. Qasem Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Republican Guard or Revolutionary Guard Corps, and also the head of Quds Force. And it was a wonderful article to kind of help you understand the IRGC, how it fits into Iranian culture. And I think too many Americans don't understand that kind of thing. Too many people in the global audience. It's like Afghanistan saying, well, the Taliban are the bad guys. What? The Islamic State are the bad guys. The Al-Qaeda are the bad guys. The Haqqani Net are the bad guys. The Paki Taliban, who hate some of the Afghani Taliban and the Baluchi Taliban. They're all different Talibans. So this is extremely complicated human terrain, and in terms of its connection to the vital interests of the United States, why should we go to all the trouble with resources and everything like that when we haven't even bothered to study the complexity of the region and realize that in almost every case you come away from a nuanced and comprehensive study of this area of the world and its problems and its history with a, you know, maybe the better discretion and security and caution are the better part of valor in developing policy here. So, I'm not completely convinced that Saudi Arabia is not trying to draw us into a larger war to serve its purposes with Iran, okay? Again, I want to put the caveat in there that Iran developing nuclear weapons is not a good thing. Unless, of course, you're the regime in Tehran and you're looking at North Korea and how nuclear weapons seem to have guaranteed an insurance policy for totalitarian regimes. But why wouldn't a totalitarian regime want this kind of assurance? I mean, if we were a totalitarian regime and we knew nuclear weapons would ensure our survival, even if we weren't, I think we would want them here in the United States. I don't think the ideologues are going to say, no, we're a big, happy democracy, and we don't need nuclear weapons as an insurance policy against, you know, existential threats. Right? So I think you got to put the other guy's shoes on, put on his thinking cap, and kind of take his position, and then take it off, take a look at what your position is, and do the analysis that way. So I say fine. Let the Chinese, let the Indians, let the Saudis, let the Germans, let the French, let them send their damn ships up there and patrol the Gulf.
Well, John, that was a fast hour on something that probably would take a few months to talk about. But you're a busy guy. You've got a lot of irons in the fire. A couple of things for you. One, if people want to keep track of you, where's a good place for them to go to keep track of you? And what projects are you working on this summer that we could look forward to reading?
Okay. Well, one thing that I have to hold off on one of the things because I haven't gotten permission yet to talk about it yet, so I'll wait on that. As far as how to keep track of me, I'm going to start off with something that's a little eclectic. I'm a regular contributor on the HNET. So if you got to Google, you know, Google H-NET, HNET, Hotel Tax November Echo Tango. And on HNET, I'm on the H-War side of things, which is Hotel Whiskey Alfa Romeo. And I have a blog there that I run every month. And I get pretty good stuff in there. There's a couple guys that kind of run on a little bit. Sometimes I'm one of them. But I do something called the Hand Grenade of the Month. Now, your readers or your listeners have to be careful here, although they'll be readers if they go there. The blog is actually on the H-War side of HNET, and it's called Hand Grenade of the Week. I've tried to get them to rename it, but it's too hard. But it's really a Hand Grenade of the Month. I write one every month. At the end of May, I wrote one for June. At the end of June, I wrote one for July. Right now, I'm riffing off something that I read on either Strategy Bridge or War in the Rocks. I forget which. I think it was War in the Rocks, about Do Generals Matter, which is based on a book by this guy, Nolan, who just won a book prize from somebody. So anyway, so if you want to follow me on H-War, you don't have to click anything. You just go to H-War and type in Kuhn or go to the blogs and follow the Hand Grenade. All the past Hand Grenades are listed there, and they make for some fun reading, and you can read my my moderate, nuanced, unimpassioned rhetoric there in black and white. Another place, if you need a daily fix, is me on Twitter, at jkuhn50, at jkuhn50. Somebody tried to steal my identity last year, so I had to actually go to the where you have to ask me to be one of my followers. It's pretty rare that I don't say, yeah, you can be my follower. But I may not follow you back, okay? But I may. You never know. I might follow you. You never know. I follow this guy called Commander Salamander. So anyway, I'm at Twitter and I'm at H-War. Projects. Great projects. No projects right now. I've got a book coming out from Prager, but it's finished. The manuscript is finished, so I'm not actually working on it anymore. I've got a couple books I'm reading that I'll be doing book reviews on. For example, one of them, just to kind of show your listeners how out there I am, I range far and I range wide, in the words of Larry McMurtry. I'm reading a translation of Klaus Witz's campaign history of Napoleon's 1796 campaign in northern Italy, translation by two guys up at the Naval War College. One of them is Nick Murray, a friend of mine. So I'm doing that as a book review, and I'm plowing through that right now, and I'm just having all kinds of fun reading it because Clausewitz is almost as acerbic as I am when he's in his critical mode. He's fun to read when he's critical because he just lets you have it. So I'm reading his campaign history of Napoleon's first campaign in Italy in 1796. So that's a lot of fun. And then I've got another book that I'm reviewing for Oxford University Press called A New Naval History. So I'm doing that. It's a cultural history of modern war. It's an anthology. So I've got that. The book that's going to come out from Prager that I finished is 100 Military Disasters. It'll probably be too expensive for anybody to buy, but who knows? You never know. Maybe we'll renegotiate the contract and make it so it's not $40 a copy at some point in the future. But, yeah, it's about 100 military disasters. I co-authored it with a guy in my department. We had another guy contribute a couple entries, like two or three entries. We picked 100 military disasters from history. Tried to spread them out, not just stay focused on the United States and Europe, but also China, Japan, Mughal Empire, Mongols, you know, all these different sort of more of a global 100 global military disasters, but it'll be mostly Eurocentric, but it's a lot of fun. Each entry is something like 1,300 words. And so if you like the way I talk and think, you might want to check that out. One of the battles, one of the military disasters I do is Hattin, which is where that Crusader army gets massacred, which initiates the Third Crusade. Well, not massacred. They get defeated. They get annihilated by Saladin near the Horns of Hattin, near the Lake of Galilee. So that's coming out. As far as long-term projects, I just finished a chapter on the culture of the United States Navy. That'll be coming out in an anthology from Cambridge University Press. Pete Mansour at Ohio State University is one of the editors on that. But that'll be out. That's kind of like one of those Williamson Murray, Alan Millett, Jim Lacy sort of anthology deals. So it'll probably get a lot of exposure. But that's coming out in the next year. But so I've done a lot of work. So I'm kind of sitting back and relaxing here and watching the fruits of my labors come to fruition.
Well, John, as always, it's a pleasure having you on board. And, hey, enjoy the rest of your summer.
Hey, thanks a lot, Sal. Thanks, Eagle One. Thanks for having me on. I know I bloviate, but, it's what I do.
Wouldn't have you any other way.
Always a pleasure, John.
Okay. Have a good one, guys.
Appreciate it. And thank you, everybody. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, Leicester Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.